From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest, Andrew Robinson, he has written more than 25 books on an unusual range of subjects: science, history of science, ancient scripts, writing systems, and archaeological decipherment, and Indian history and culture. They include 7 biographies, some about what we are guessing is his favorite topic, the physicist Albert Einstein. His new book, Einstein on the Run, is the first account of how Britain gave sanctuary to Einstein. And we welcome Andrew Robinson to Cool Science Radio. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Tell us why you wrote this book.
Well, I wrote a book on Einstein for the centenary of his relativity theory in 2005. And I looked at it many years later, about 2 years ago. I looked at it and I thought, my God, there's almost nothing in this book about his relationship with Britain, which is, you know, where I live and where I come from. And I suddenly thought there's a need for a book on Britain and Einstein.
Yeah, and it's fascinating that that people in Britain embraced him the way they did, because before relativity was proven through the solar eclipse, there were a lot of people in the Allied forces that felt that scientists weren't very smart in Germany or Austria because of the war and those sorts of things. How do you think that happened?
Well, obviously the war was very, very disruptive. And as a result, the communications didn't occur between German physics and British physics very well at that time. But the truth is, I'm afraid, is that the British physicists, whom Einstein really did revere, they also looked down upon relativity for a long time, actually, from 1905 right up to 1919. Most of them, except for Arthur Eddington and one or two others, thought it was wrong. And then the solar eclipse came along in 1919, and they all changed their minds in Britain. In Germany, he had some supporters, but he had quite a few people who doubted his theory as well. I mean, Max Planck was a supporter, but not everyone was.
So Einstein had a great passion for the work of some of the scientists in Britain, and probably that's where his desire to visit and be in Britain began. And those scientists were Isaac Newton, Michael Faraday, and James Clerk Maxwell. Can you talk about how he came to be inspired by them?
Yes, he first came across Newton when he was in his very early years. As a child, he was reading a book about physics written by a German author, and he got excited by Newton. And I'm not quite sure where he came across Faraday's work, but James Clerk Maxwell came a bit later when he was a teenager starting his education at college in Switzerland, and he realized that Maxwell was the one who really spoke to him, and he actually said later in 1925, he said to somebody that I owe everything to Maxwell. And I think it was Maxwell he used to keep as a portrait on his wall in Berlin. No other scientist, just Maxwell. And he felt, as many British physicists did, that Maxwell was quite an extraordinary combination of theory and experiment.
Mm. Well, tell us a little bit about Maxwell's work. It was the electromagnetic radiation that he formulated the theory of that. And is that what the magnetism, is that what first attracted, well, I'm kind of making a pun there without realizing it, Albert Einstein?
I think it was the application of mathematics to experiment that appealed to him most in Maxwell's work, the electromagnetic theory. It was the sophisticated mathematics that Maxwell was capable of applying And that that really did appeal to Einstein and had a big effect on his approach to physics. I mean, right through his life. And, you know, at the end of his life, in the last two decades of his life in the United States, he was really trying to work purely with mathematics to understand nature.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Andrew Robinson, who has written Einstein on the Run, How Britain Saved the World's Greatest Scientist. One of the things I like about Einstein and some other folks is that he knew whose shoulders he stood on, the giant shoulders of Newton by modifying the electrodynamics of Maxwell to come up with relativity. He knew that he couldn't have done it without the prior work that came before him. And it's interesting because you bump into people every once in a while who are standing on a soapbox sort of beating their chest, talking about what they have done, and they really don't give credit to those that came before them.
Yes, I think that Einstein always gave credit in his richest period of his life, up to, you know, the 1920s as a scientist. He always gave credit, and he gave particular credit to the people you just mentioned. A little later, towards the end, he was a bit less inclined to talk about the giants. And I think that was probably not due to feeling that he was too famous. I think he just forgot. He forgot just how much he depended on these earlier thinkers. He never diminished them, but he didn't talk about them quite so much at the end. But during the high point of his life as a scientist, he was very modest in that way, and I think he was a modest man, really, fundamentally.
And I don't think we have time in this program to, on this particular day, to go through it, but, you know, one of the other things about Einstein is that his fingerprints, to quote Walter Isaacson, are on all of today's modern technology. So these aren't just heady subjects and theorems that he's come up with, but as a result of them, they have driven so much of technology that we have today.
Well, yes, because it wasn't just relativity, of course. He worked in quantum theory in a very early and important phase, and though he disagreed with some aspects of quantum mechanics, he certainly is a pioneer of quantum theory.
Yeah.
And that's crucial.
So tell us about Einstein. For when he was a young man, he was sort of without a country for a period of time. He gave up his German citizen, I believe, and applied for, was it Swiss citizenship? And that was before he came to Britain. But take us through a little bit of a history of that.
Well, he gave up his German citizenship as a teenager because he did not want to be conscripted militarily. And he knew that if he stayed in Germany as a German citizen, he would be very soon conscripted. And just before that happened, he left Germany and went to stay with his parents in Italy in 1895, I think. And he was still, less than 18 at that point. He then stayed with them and worked all on his own on physics. And then he went to be educated in Switzerland, and at that time he was stateless. He had no citizenship at all. He was not German, and he was not Italian, and he was not Swiss, but then he took Swiss citizenship fairly soon, and he retained it for the rest of his life, I think I'm correct in saying. Even when he came to the United States, he was also a Swiss citizen. He kept dual citizenship, and I think he identified with Switzerland more than certainly more than with Germany, and he felt quite happy in Switzerland as a young man, so I think he wanted to hold on to the Swiss citizenship.
So in 1919 is when he becomes world famous, when the theory of relativity is proven. And then I believe it's not until several years later that he moves to, is it Manchester first in England?
He visited Britain for the first time after visiting the United States in 1921. He went to the United States, then he went to Britain for a short visit in 1921, and he went to Manchester, and he gave a lecture to a large number of people. And then he went to London, and he gave a famous lecture in London, and he started to become, you know, part of the British way of life around that time. People really began to in a way, to sort of love him after 1921. But he had a rather awkward relationship, as I'm sure you know, with Germany, even as early as 1921.
Yes.
In Britain, he was welcomed, but in Germany, there were an awful lot of critics of his work. And even long before the Nazi period, there were many, many, many critics, and some of them got together and published a book in 1931. Before the Nazis, the book was entitled 100 Authors Against Einstein. So that gives you some idea.
Absolutely.
My mother would say, oh, they're just jealous. But she'd say it with a Southern accent, too. They're just jealous. But
I think some of them were, definitely.
Yeah. You know, Einstein was so smart. I mean, he didn't even think special relativity was a big deal. But, of course, relativity was the real hard one. But as smart as he was, and once he figured something out, he would go and try to prove it mathematically. And as good as he was with math and being able to collaborate with Planck and some of these other giants in the world of physics, the thing that amazes me the most is his imagination. I mean, he was like 12 or 13 years old when he was imagining being on a train and a photon of light and how that would be relative to his position. When he came up with that thought experiment of jumping off of a building with rocks in his hands and then releasing the rocks and watching the rocks relative to him, the rocks weren't moving as he was plummeting towards the sidewalk. But he used his imagination so much to be able to get to a point where he could come up with some of this heavy lifting.
Yes. It was not unique, but very remarkably developed in Einstein. And most of it was done alone. You know, he was just thinking. Thought experiment. He was not working with other people at that point, but he did need mathematical help, as we all know. He needed mathematicians to help him later because he recognized that his mathematics was not as sophisticated as he would have liked. And before he developed general relativity in 1915. He had quite a lot of mathematical help from one or two colleagues, for which he was very grateful.
And using his imagination by himself, working alone, I mean, his teachers in the early days of school commented that, you know, here's a guy that doesn't really want to interact with kids. He wants to do his own thing. And before that, his parents thought he might have a learning disability because of his inability to construct full sentences. Can you talk about
yes,
that?
Yes, it's true. It's true. They took him to a doctor when he was really very young. I think about 3 or 4 years old, I think something like that. And it turned out that he wanted to be able to formulate the entire sentence in his head before uttering it out loud. And so he had this mental idea that he should know the sentence before he started speaking.
Yeah. So fast forwarding, because we just have a few minutes left, to talk about his time, his relationship with Oxford and his time in Britain. He came seeking refuge against the anti-Semitism that was rearing its head in Germany. Can you talk
well,
about
yes,
that refuge?
He did, but that came slightly later. It's quite the truth is that he first came to England in 1921, and then he came back to visit Oxford in 1931, 32, and 33. Three visits, all fairly short, but quite intense. And in 1931, he came to give lectures, and he just loved the idea of being among British physicists. He didn't have any. There's no problem from anti-Semitism at that time in 31. It was, you know, it was not too bad. But by the time he came back in 32, and then, of course, in 1933, he came after the rise of the Nazis, then there was a real problem, and he was effectively a refugee in Oxford in the middle of 1933, and then he stayed on and off in Britain during 1933. He came back to meet Winston Churchill in July 1933 after leaving Oxford, and they had discussions about the Nazi threat. Then he went back to Belgium, which is where he was living at that time with his wife. And he came back after hitting out against the Nazis very publicly in August of 1933. He came back in September to Britain, and he was effectively in a secret hideaway in the depths of the English countryside to escape any risk to his life at that point.
And he spent a lot of time in solitude in the English countryside. And one of the things I just want to point out about your book that's so wonderful are all the photos. You know, it just dawned on me, Einstein was a very photographed individual. Whether or not he was photogenic is another.
I think he was. I think he's awesome.
There's
looking.
No one that, yeah. that there's no one that doesn't know what Einstein looked like.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, that's true.
And
that's true.
And such wonderful photos. My favorite is when Einstein is standing beside an unfinished bronze bust of him, alongside its sculptor Jacob Epstein, and
yes.
apparently this bust is now in the Tate Gallery in London.
That's right. Yes. It's a lovely photo, isn't it? Because Einstein is dressed very casually, as he was. He had very few clothes. I mean, he left Belgium in a great hurry, and he took his science papers and his science books with him, but he only had a few clothes to travel with. So he's constantly looking very casual. And there's another photo in the book of him in the secret encampment in Norfolk, wearing what appears to be his dressing gown, looking extremely like a hermit, which is what he said, I'm like a hermit here. I don't need to eat roots and herbs, but I'm really a hermit. And I think he loved being a hermit. He liked to think about mathematics, and he was very happy to do that. But he also had some relationships with local people. You know, there's a story about him being introduced to a little boy by one of his guards, said, "Here's my son, this little boy," and Einstein stroked him on the forehead and said, "Double crown, he'll go a long way."
Unfortunately, we're just about out of time. Andrew Robinson has been our guest in his new book, Einstein on the Run. It's the first account of how Britain gave sanctuary to Einstein. Just a quick question, Andrew. You've written six biographies on Einstein. What one thing do you want to know about Einstein that you don't know about?
I think I'd like to understand a little bit better than I do why he left Europe forever in 1933.
Yeah. Okay.
He never came back. He went to the United States and he never left again. He never went back to any country in Europe. I mean, Germany, of course, you can understand, but he never came to any other country. He never even gave a lecture. And he never went to Israel. He just stayed where he was in the United States. I'd like to understand that.
I bet it has something to do with the exodus of other great physicists to work in Los Alamos on the atomic bomb post-World War II. That might have had something to do with it.
He had a lot of company. Great, great physicists were with him, and that certainly helped. And physics was the thing that drove his life. There's no question. He came to the United States so he could be on his own when he wanted to be as a physicist, and also where he could meet others if he wanted to. He wanted the freedom to be alone, and think about physics and not have all these political pressures on him. Of course, he did get involved in American politics, but actually he was able to be alone when he wanted to in the United States. I think in Europe, that was very difficult. He couldn't get away from all sorts of problems in Europe, and that's probably why he left. He wanted to think about right. physics.
Andrew, thanks so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.